Coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Well, hello everybody. Happy Tuesday night. Hope you've had a great week. I have been madly prepping things for Cygames, and I cannot wait. Cygames starts tomorrow, on Friday. I leave tomorrow at 4 a.m. I've got everything packed, and it is going to be awesome again this year. It is the first of its kind live competition between competitors who have psi ability, everything from remote viewing to psychokinesis, mind sight, all kinds of disciplines involving psi. And it's unique. It's one of a kind. Hakeem Isler is the organizer. We've had him on, and it's absolutely awesome, folks. Last year was the inaugural year. This year is the second, and I cannot wait to see so many more. It's an amazing community of folks that come together for that. Speaking of amazing folks, our good friend Gretchen Cornwall was supposed to join us this evening. Godspeed to you, Gretchen. I hope that your shoot with National Geographic goes well. We would never, ever keep folks from the things that they have worked hard for. So she is in the midst of that and will be rescheduling her appearance to talk about Templar Cave Royston. In her stead tonight, I am more than happy to welcome. First off, let me apologize before I welcome our guest, because I did misannounce our guest last week, and I realized it after I walked away from things and started fixing the audio issue in the beginning of the episode while things were still live, that I misannounced Bob Spearing. I had announced him at the beginning of the show, then at the middle of the show, announced our guest, Sylvie Sterling, who is the cat whisperer and Lyrid alien expert, who we will be having on in the second part of the episode tonight. So I'm sorry, Bob, for introducing you as Sylvie in the second part of the show last week. With that being said, I'm very happy to welcome our guest this evening. He is actually the host of The Rundown Live, Kristen T. Harris. He covers all kinds of topics. Great interviews over there. He's been doing this since 2011. But in addition, stop on by and follow his page on Facebook, Giantology. That is Giantology, Giantology. Kristen T. Harris is one of the people who, really the person who spent years going through and culling through Smithsonian documents and finding news articles, real news articles, things like that about giant skeletons found, stuff like that. So if you see those genuine articles, folks, online, it's more than likely Kristen's work that brought you that. So this is a topic that fascinates me, Kristen, the idea of giants, the idea of another race of humanoid, whatever you want to call it, that is massive and huge and talked about by cultures all over the world. So welcome to the show for the first time. How are you this evening, ma'am?
Dude, I'm doing great, dude. Your intro reminds me of UHF. Have you ever seen UHF with Weird Al?
Oh, yeah.
And they got Philo, and it's like, secrets of the universe. And he's sitting there with, like, exactly, two, like, electrical conductors, and he's like, hold these. And then Weird Al gets shocked, and he's sitting there, and he's, like, getting electrocuted. You know, your intro had that UHF vibes. I dig it already. And, man, I'm a lot older than I look. I'm approaching 50 years old, and I know I'm a harlot and a heartbreaker, but age is catching up to me. And for a long time, probably since at least, 2005, I've been digging through the Library of Congress online, all these old newspaper articles on giant human skeletons. And it all stemmed from a theological debate I had with my brother about atheism. At that time, basically, my brother asked me why I believe in Christianity and religious texts. And, you know, I don't know. I might have had a few brewskis anyway. I'm like, what about the giants? And he's like, there's no proof of giants. And I'm like, well, they'd be in the Library of Congress. And all of a sudden, I started pulling up all these articles, giant human skeletons found. And then I kept finding them. He's like, well, that's just one. And then I found another and then another and then another. And before you knew it, I started cutting these and I started publishing these in a news blog called City Now. And City Now is a segment of the journal Sentinel. And I applied to be a blogger there and they were dumb enough to give me a blog. And I had some of the most viral articles I think that blog had ever seen. They told me I was a top traffic blogger out of any City Now site. And worked with a lot of different major news, like a badge of honor, but I also learned and made a lot of mistakes along the way. And eventually they let me go because I'm an independent guy. I'm not Republican. I'm not Democrat. If you ask me, you know, it's two sides of the same coin at the end of the day. And the only things that they agree on is what really destroys our sovereignty and freedom in America.
How to screw us.
Right. At the end of the day, it's like, screw the American people. So I started publishing these. And it would be weird, man. I'd publish these articles and they'd go ultra viral. I was getting the dopamine hits because back in the day, remember if you shared an article, it would say Facebook, it would say 5 likes, 6 shares. So when you published an article on like the Journal Sentinel or any major newspaper, you saw how much it was aggregated, how many people liked it. And I'm reading it. I'm like looking at this like it started out with 30 likes and I went back. It was like 480 likes. And then I looked and it all of a sudden it had 5,000 shares. And I'm like, what the heck? This stuff's going viral. And all of a sudden I started reading the comments and there was like one guy's like, yeah, I'm a producer for the TV series Doctor Who. This stuff is crazy. And, you know, I'm just L.A. Marzulli reached out to me, a guy named Steve Quayle. All these people that started doing this before I did that, at that time, not too many people heard of L.A. Marzulli or Steve Quayle. Ancient Aliens wasn't hot. I mean, they're probably on their 13th season right now, and we're talking about almost 20 years ago. So this was before a lot of that, but a lot of those type of individuals from the Ancient Aliens culture were emailing me and reaching out, and I didn't do aliens. I just didn't. I didn't do UFOs. I didn't do aliens. I listened to a little bit of Alex Jones, and that was always taboo. And when I listened to William Cooper, because back then you'd have to go to this like ghetto of the internet to find the forum where they have the audio links. Maybe it was hourofthetime.com. I don't remember. And I would listen to William Cooper and he'd talk UFOs. And I'd be like, well, that's kind of crazy. Your dad worked on the base and they turned off the nukes and everything else. Which was a little bit weird. So I kind of stayed away from the UFO phenomenon. However, in 2014 or 2015, I can't remember, I gave a presentation at the University of Milwaukee, Wisconsin at a conference. And at the back of the conference was Chase Klutschke, who she came up to me and was working with L.A. Marzulli at the time. And my whole presentation was on giant human skeletons and occultism and the secret society's interest in them, amongst everything else, but specifically dealing with Wisconsin, because we had a lot of effigy mounds here and a lot of them unearthed large human skeletons. And I have all these newspaper articles. Some of them have pictures of the skeletons. Some of them have historical reference. Some of them talk about in detail finding giants with guns, like a 30-pound musket sitting next to them, a flint stock musket. History about Romans taking down a prince, taking down a 20-foot-tall giant. You know, the terms like cut them down to size. That's where some of those things are believed to come from. It's really interesting. So I started publishing these things, and a lot of people started reaching out, and a lot of people within the science community started to really character assassinate me and say, well, you know, there's about 1,000 newspaper articles, but it's all fake news. And it's like, well, how do you, just because you say it's fake doesn't mean it's fake. He's like, well, where are the bones? And so then I started looking into it, and a lot of these articles, not all of them, but out of the 1,000 I've dug up, there's probably 100 or plus mentions of the Smithsonian, of legitimate college, like professors. Locally, we had P.R. Hoy. We had, let's see, who else did we add? We had Charles E. Brown. We had other people who opened up these effigy mounds that had giant human skeletons in them. And they recorded some of these skeletons between 11 and 15 feet tall. West Bend, Wisconsin, Racine, Wisconsin, In fact, I went that, so I got so interested in this. I literally got my fat ass out of Milwaukee, went to Madison, went to the Archaeological Society, and pulled boxes that had an inch of dust on them from the 1800s to read handwritten notes by these individuals. And it was funny because when I signed into the card, the last person was in the 90s to sign out this box that I pulled. And of course, it was L.A. Marzulli.
Wow.
Wow. And so L.A. Marzulli came through, and I'm like, well, I better reach out to L.A. Marzulli. You know, I got a lot of contacts, and I started talking to L.A., and L.A.'s like, yeah, there's like all these elongated skulls. There's all these different types of human skulls, because I was finding not only newspaper articles about giant human skeletons, I was finding them about mass graveyards in the United States found of sprites. And I'm like, what the hell is a sprite? And I had to look it up, and it was a fairy. And I'm like, well, why is it that they're finding hundreds of these human little baby skeletons that are like a foot and a half, 2 feet tall, you know, in mass graves? I don't know. These were just like peculiar things that kept popping up when I was looking through all these things. And once I started publishing these, all of a sudden the search term giant human skeleton was no longer pulling up human giant skeleton articles from the Library of Congress. And so if I took the word human out and just kept it as giant skeleton, then all of a sudden a lot of these came up. But now I had to comb through mammoth skulls, skeletons. I had to pull, you know, large saber-toothed tiger skeletons, whatever skeleton they found that was large, I had to dig through, and it was made a lot more difficult on me. But I was able to find a lot, a ton of these articles. And so I started looking into the history of it and the mythology of it. And obviously Genesis 6:4 is the popular verse a lot of people talk about, where it says that there was giants on the earth in those days before and after the flood. You know, obviously Deuteronomy 2:11, which also was accounts of giants as the Anakims and the Moabites call them, the Immims. Deuteronomy 3:13, and the rest of Gilead and Bashan, being the king of Og, gave I unto the half-tribe of Manasseh, an area region of Argob. Og was a king and a giant. He was about, they believe, between 11 and 13 feet tall. And I started going through these, and then I found out it goes even older, that Crete itself was known as the land of giants, gigantes, before it was known as Crete.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you start getting into Greek mythology especially, you know, there's the story of the Cyclops, all kinds of things. So and once again, giants have been in storied histories across the globe, and it's very interesting because all of a couple few years ago, and I'll pop it up on screen here, the skull of Dragon Man was found in China, and this was found in a well. It was a deathbed confession by a guy's father who was dying, and he was like, we found this skull out in the field years ago. It scared the hell out of all of us, so we took it and threw it in the bottom of the well. He dug in the well, and he actively found the skull of what is now known as Dragon Man, which is an actual skull. Folks, feel free to look this up. Like, you can find it on Science Alert. This is from extremetech.com. But when you look at the size difference between A on the left, the human skull, and B, Dragon Man, you're talking like a size, like 1.5 times the size cranium. Like, this is a huge skull, and they measure the fact that it'd probably be close to 9.5 feet tall, something like that.
Well, I got on a screen, on my screen, there was an organization known as the Chemung Giants, and they had horns on their head. They grew horns protruding from their heads, and Chemung is in New York. Do you know what the term Chemung means?
No.
It means the land of the horn, meaning, why did they call it the land of the horn? Because the giants that lived there were tall and they had horns. Here's a newspaper article. It says Chemung's predecessors had huge giants, were 7 feet plus tall, and they had horns. One of the most remarkable scientific discoveries in history made here, 68 skeletons of men living 700 years ago, and they were giants, and they had horns. And guess who shows up? The Smithsonian Institute. Then they mentioned, you know, a professor who looked at it and everything else, but the indigenous people called it Chemung because it's the land of the horn. That's what it means, the horn. And they're like, well, it might mean because it's a mastodon horn or everything else, but yeah. It's just funny that they found giants with horns in the area that they called Chemung. And Chemung means horns, and the giants had horns protruding from their skull, much like what you would see in a science fiction movie with the devil, per se.
Yeah, yeah. You know, interestingly, whenever you look at things like one that's regularly referenced is Moses, Elijah, things like that. And you know, granted, the horns on them, in their sculptures, in their paintings, things like that are much more like horns of fire, horns of understanding. But there they are with bumps on their head, you know, in most sculptures. So it's
fascinating. Well, the horns normally represent moon worship or lunar worship. One of the guys that was my mentor that I knew for several years personally was a guy named Jordan Maxwell. Mm-hmm. And Jordan Maxwell believed it equated to the lunar worship or moon worship. And it recommended wisdom because horns, you know, obviously a crescent moon looks like two horns. But it could be something different. That was just his interpretation. Yeah. And Jordan and I didn't agree on everything. Today, to this very day, humans still grow horns out of their head. They call it, it's a certain disease that, and it's related to tumors, right? And if you go look it up, humans with horns growing out of their head, you'll get some pretty weird and crazy pictures of people growing horns out of their head because it's a real deal. Put the Bible aside, several of the world's most influential authors all throughout history verify these accounts of giants and gods in the island of Crete. People such as Diodorus, Siculus, Pliny, Strabo, Plutarch, and Plato, just to name a few. In addition to these historical accounts by some of the world's most trusted authorities on so many things, there is also the science with real-life giant bones that have been found on Crete. In fact, the largest bones that have ever been found were discovered on that very island, which may prove this was truly the home or the land of the giants, as they originally called it. During the Cretan War, from 2005 to 200, which is five years, which is 200 years before Christ, a massive giant skeleton was discovered on the island. This giant was measured at the length of 33 cubits, which equates to nearly 42 feet tall. The Roman Lucius Flaccus was a notable eyewitness to the gigantic bones, and the Greek writer under the Roman Empire, Hadrian, and Phlegon of the Tralles also mentions the discovery of several giant skeletons. And that's not to bring in the esoteric books of the Bible that they removed, the books of Enoch, where it talks about the fallen angels, which, by the way, a lot of people call giants Nephilim, but they're not. Nephilim were the fallen angels who mated with women and brought forth
and beget
the giants.
Exactly.
Right. People don't want, like, it's just simple. People make so many, misinterpretations, and they misspeak, and I do it myself. You know, sometimes my Wisconsin accent there kind of messes up words, but you know, it says in the book, was a book of Enoch, chapter 3, if they want to look it up themselves, verse 9, and they became pregnant, and they bare great giants whose height were 3,000 ells, who consumed all the accusations of men, and when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them and devoured mankind. They became cannibals. And what are all the stories? Fee-fi-fo-fum, he's going to put you in the pot and eat ya. He's going to cook you. Trolls and Lord of the Rings. Oh, they're going to put you in the pot and cook you. They're going to eat you. They're giant human looking beings. Giants.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, especially whenever you start looking at the history of it here in America, there is the story from the Northern Paiute. I mean, the Paiute, it's no story. It's actual history for them, even to this day. And I am trying to remember the maiden's name. Who actively has a dress, like a ceremonial piece of wear that is partially woven out of the red hair from the giants of Lovelock Cave.
Well, Lovelock Cave is a whole nother. That's a very popular story. It's like, you know, and Lovelock Cave is one of those interesting stories where it kind of mixes in with indigenous folklore, which it brings some truth to what they claimed, which is that there was a war between the gray giants and the red hair giants. And my memory is a little weak because I'm getting old, but one of the two types of giants were cannibal, and the local indigenous tribes teamed up with one of the sets of giants to overthrow the cannibal giants that were eating their children because, you know, baby tastes best. Well, according to Snowpiercer anyways, but, you know, it's one of those things. And if you don't know what Snowpiercer is, it's a sci-fi movie about a train that, you know, in this dystopic world. And that's basically what they said. You know, he's like, I know that baby tastes best, but, you know, and it's dark humor. Anyways, it's just one of those things that people don't talk about, and it's in their history. Even here in Wisconsin, I talked to indigenous tribes, and I'm like, well, were giants ever mentioned as part of your history? And he goes, oh, we don't talk about that. It's a sacred story.
Yeah.
It's a sacred story, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, it's interesting because a lot of things are like that. You know, we talk a lot about this on the show, especially when it comes to cryptozoology, Kristen, and the idea of stories change, not to the native cultures that they come from, but once we get a hold of them. If you look at the concept of Wendigo in the Northeast, if you look at the traditional concept of that, it is a possessing spirit that twists the person. Wasn't until creepypasta and video games that we started seeing them as like partial deer creatures with skull heads and antlers. That is nowhere in the tradition of Wendigo. When you get into things like the, and it's better that I don't get it right, the Naldachin, the skinwalker, and the idea of, we don't talk about that. Because much like Freddy Krueger, you talk about that, you give it energy, and it begins.
Right, so on that topic, I spent the weekend with the Navajo Rangers. They have their own TV show.
Yeah, they're great.
You know,
cool dudes.
Yeah, they were staying at my friend's home where I was staying at as well because I was going to go cover Contact at the Desert. It was the year that Alejandro Mayorkas appeared there and popped in and was there. A lot of people don't realize that. Captured a picture. I'm like, Dad, is that the head of the Department of Defense? What is he doing here looking into UFOs? That's a little weird. I mean, it's just you. Why UFOs? Or maybe it's some other things. Who knows? Governments are interested in a lot of things that are peculiar and outside the norm, which, by the way, a lot of the things that were peculiar and weird 50 years ago are now the norm, like you mentioned. I don't know what it is about witchcraft, but every girl I try to go on a date with is got crystals and they're all got tarot cards and they're trying to do, oh, can I read your tarot card? Hey. I'm like, oh, this is, yeah, see, there you go. Everyone's all into this, like, you know, voodoo type of occultism, you know, all into astrotheology, astrology, and everyone's kind of gone the way of secularism. Mm-hmm. Which I'm okay with people doing that if they're good people, you know. But I think a lot of times people open the doors to things that they don't understand.
Well, and that is something that we talk about regularly, especially whenever it comes to, like, I will always say, and it is so much so that even whenever I present, Kristen, I have a rote phrase. I believe in the existence of a large hominid creature known as Sasquatch in North America and beyond. But I also think that there is something else that is using the trope of our mind and our want of experience as a point of ingress to this dimension. And that's whether you're doing CE5 and you're saying, okay, I'm here, I would love an experience. Like, dude, just open the friggin' window and leave a pizza on the windowsill for the vampire. You know what I mean? Like, like, you've quite literally left the window open. So it's interesting the number of people who have CE5 or have invited that, and suddenly their experience is not that great. you know.
Well, it's just one of those things. It's I have a lot of questions because, you know, Satan is the great deceiver. And, you know, you can go to a psychic and they'll tell you something that nobody else will know because you don't think anyone else was in the room. But who knows what other spiritual entities were in the room and where they're getting their information from. They don't know if it was a demon or an angel or, you know, a djinn or whatever it is people believe in. And I'm not saying that I know everything and that there isn't the possibility of other life out there of things. Sure. I mean, they have the Yeti. The Yeti sounds a lot like a white albino Sasquatch, you know?
Just angrier.
Where do these stories come from, you know?
Just vengeful.
Angry. Don't dig for gold and silver. I think that was Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. I saw that in a movie once, right? The claymation.
That's right. Well,
silver and gold.
You know, there's a... we were just talking about it with Steve Bassett the other night on the show.
I've had Steve on. He's an interesting dude.
I love Steve. But there was the article that came out a few years ago about that the Pentagon was actively injecting false narrative. And more than injecting false narrative, using the narratives of the UFO UAP community as cover for their programs. So it was like, why would we hire a PSYOP officer and go through and write all these things when the community is making great cover stories for us?
We'll just tap them
on social media. Oh no, like this was an actual thing that they came out and were like, yeah. So whenever you're talking about the guy from the DOD being a contact in the desert, there you have it. Like,
well, here's the other thing that's really interesting on that subject. At that conference, I got to ask Nick Pope some questions, and I'm friends with Andrew Collins and Hugh Newman are personal friends of mine, amongst some other people I've met throughout the years over there. But Mark D'Antonio, who is a top astronomer and also has had numerous clearances, was giving a presentation on UFOs, the Fast Mover program, underwater UFOs, and he opened up the questions for the community. And I wanted to ask what I think is the most genuine and most difficult question. And it was like the whole audience had an aha moment because Mark couldn't answer my question, at least not honestly. But he did as best as he could. And I said, how come? First of all, I asked him, how many, since he's the chief video forensic officer at MUFON, right? He sees all the videos. He sees every UFO video. I'm sure for the government, too. He sees them all. I said, how many of them are real? And he's like, well, there's a couple that our government has declassified that are real. And then I followed up and I said, well, as I've noticed, it's the military who captures those. Who's to say that those aren't our own government's programs validating that the new technology works? Because before you're going to test it in war against your enemy, you're going to make sure that you can fuck with and cheat your current military and that it works. And he said, well, that's a really good question, and I have that same question, and that's it. And everyone in the crowd was like, what? That could be our own, like, advanced technology?
Absolutely.
Then, of course, Mark's like, but where did we get the technology from? You know, it could be Nazi Germany. Who knows?
Sure.
But, like, you know, we don't really know. We don't really know where they're getting this technology from. We do know, I think that, like, withholding advanced technology is a real thing. I think that there's a real possibility there. But I've made a lot of friends in the UFO community, and I think I've lost some of those friends, a lot of it, because I've decided to stick with the people who have treated me well, which is, you know, obviously the people, like, Alex Jones and individuals like that, where I've been appearing over the last 15 years. And as Alex has been crucified, you know, I felt a little fallout. But you know what? I've always been a hardcore person that I, you know, people treat me good. I stick with them no matter the hardships or whatever they go with, you know. And, you know, I've been blessed for sticking through that. Doesn't mean that I agree with everything that happens over there.
But absolutely.
At the same time, you know, nobody's done me wrong and my experience with them is good. I'm going to continue to be loyal and be a good person. And I am loyal and I am a good person. And I think that there's a lot of people in the UFO. Richard Dolan gave me his cell phone number. He was so impressed. I had breakfast with them. He invited me to have, you know, conversations with them. And as soon as he found out I was on Jones's show, he stopped talking to me. You know, just stuff like that. I have no problem calling it out. You know, I text Dolan now and he still won't respond, you know. And back in the day, he'd talk to me all the time.
Yep.
He's like, well, how do you know so much about transhumanism? Well, I ran as a candidate for president for the Transhumanist Party in 2020 because I wanted to challenge the ethics. But I learned a lot about futurism, that it's not all doom and gloom, but that there's a lot of good things. And
yeah,
I'm a little bit of a technophobe. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to go get robot titties or anything like that, you know, that glow in the dark. You know, you've seen those things, right?
Oh, yeah.
They can make the jugs glow in the dark, and everyone's like, whoa. You know, I don't get the cyberpunk culture, and I don't know if I ever will, but I know it's coming. I know that's the future. It's going to be Kia Boys meets cyberpunk meets Grand Theft Auto, whatever we're going to deal with. Just look at how the RoboCops are working out. You know, the surveillance state is growing and everything else. And here we're talking about UFOs because the Epstein files got completely deranged. You know what's interesting about the Epstein files? For the first time ever in history, our government did a release that they gave us a search bar for. Have you ever thought about that?
Yeah.
Why is it that they created a search bar for the Epstein files, but every other release they've ever done, they've just done a dump and let you sort through it? It's because they want to be able to filter what you see and what you hear. This way, if you have a search term, they don't want you to find.
What you're looking for.
Yeah.
What you're looking for. What
you're looking for. Right.
They can thought police you and easily find out which side you might be on by how you're searching. Then look at your IP and crawl it and figure out where you've been and what you've been searching. Thanks,
Are you
Snowden.
On the dark web, you know.
Someday I'll have Snowden on the show, and we'll have real conversations. You know what I mean?
I'm surprised that guy's still alive. But
me
I think
too,
that,
man.
Well, you know, I think it's one of those things. Who thought Gary Webb would last, you know, 20 years? But finally, they got him. Eventually, they got him.
And even this, you know, to bring it back home, even the topic of this, I shared with you all of last week the, you know, what's going on at the Smithsonian. Hearing that was happening. But that has been a question on a lot of people's minds for a long time when it comes to this topic. When it comes to this topic, a couple others, you know, specifically how a big chunk of the Grand Canyon suddenly became a national park after a dude and a news article and something published. I want to say it was in National Geographic that said, like, you know, Climber finds cave full of ancient treasures.
That's Kincaid's cave.
Yeah, yeah. And
you
suddenly,
want to hear an interesting
suddenly
story?
You can't climb. You can't go nowhere near it. Nothing like that. Like, suddenly we had a national park system.
I know a guy that snuck into there and snuck into that area and was really close to the alleged temple of Isis, and then he got arrested. Mm. But he claims to have seen Anubis paintings, all that kind of stuff. Like, I think he said more like hieroglyphics, Anubis hieroglyphics, things like that on the wall. That individual's name is Timothy Hogan, which I'm sure you know. You know Timothy. I know him.
We're connected
every
on
once
Facebook.
In a while.
Yeah,
I text him every once in a while, and I saw an interview with him and Johnny Eknock last night, and I'm like, shit, I know Hogan. I've been talking to him about the ever-burning lamp, which is something a lot of people don't realize in history, that they had a lamp that could burn forever. They literally would put it in tombs, and 1,000 years later, somebody would open the tomb, and the lamp would still be freaking burning, and no one could understand how they made the technology. And it's mentioned over 130 different times by different people, scholars in history, that they had lamps that could burn thousands of years and it would never run out of oil. They call them the ever-burning lamps. It's a real thing.
Wow.
The Rosicrucians talk about them. The Masons talk about them. It's a Masonic secret. I'm kind of anti-Mason, so it's kind of funny when I have a lot of friends who are Masons and top Masons, and they'll talk to me because I know what I'm talking about. I've done a lot of investigation. I understand that the Masonic lodges are as diverse as the American people are. There are people that are more of the mystery Babylonian religion, and then there's people that believe it's downright the truth Christianity that they walked off of Noah's Ark, you know. And it's just, you can believe whatever you want, but at the end of the day, you can tell by the fruit of the fruit of the seeds that they plant, you know, what they really are at the end of the day. You know, it's one of those things where They're dying. Masonic lodges are dying. Some of our lodges in Wisconsin are shutting down. It's interesting. It's interesting to see how it is impacting society. The conspiracy culture, the pop conspiracy culture that they tried to kill. And it's funny. People like me are still censored because I was on the OG fake news list with InfoWars and Drudge Report and Mike Adams and Freaked Out Project and the Anti-Media and the Anonymous and all those original mofos that are out there, and mad props of the ones that are still around, like the Rundown Live, and I give props to Jones. But we got censored the hell out of everything. But now there's this new generation that gets away scot-free with saying whatever the hell they want. And most of it's bullshit, not even true. But, you know, you or I talk about 9/11, all of a sudden we get censored.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and it's interesting because there is so much out there. Even right now.
The like ice
this,
wall.
This guy, wall, oh my Lord. Know? Oh,
it's
my,
the ice wall. There's a whole other world outside of the ice wall.
I have a guest that anytime that it veers to there, I have to pull him back hard. And it reminds me of, because, you know, the audience knows and many of my friends know,
you know,
I am a former on-air producer for AJ. And that is one of my favorites ever was whenever he would, because he loved talking trends with David Icke. He loved it. But hey, somebody get a hold of David Icke, but tell him we're not talking about lizard men today.
Well, I mean,
no, like, lizard that's people.
Just it. The deal is, like, David Icke had a weird way. Like, first of all, people don't know this, but David Icke got his major start because of Jordan Maxwell.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a falling out. I don't know what the falling out ever was about. I never asked Jordan. I also know Jordan Maxwell and Fritz Springmeier had beef. But like it's just dumb beef. You know, it's like Mark Dyson Jones or, you know, whatever. You got these dumb beefs that go on and it kind of pulls
clash.
Away.
Egos clash.
Yeah, they do. And sometimes it's for the benefit, right? You know, two tribal teams fighting each other gets a lot of clicks, gets a lot of views, and it's not necessarily always bad. It isn't. But, you know, with Ike, a way of trying to sound non-anti-Semitic by making everyone that was Jewish a reptile. You know what I'm saying? I mean, essentially, that's what I got out of it. So you don't like dislike Jews, but you want to say that these Rothschilds and these evil bankers and these people funding the New World Order are lizard people, really. But, you know, there are some crazy anomalies with DNA, with our blood types.
Mm.
You know, like, what is it? What does it mean? I don't know. I do know that the Rothschilds believe that they're ancestors of Nimrod. And Nimrod in Albert Mackey's Encyclopedia of Freemasonry is the founder of the craft. He's the founder of the craft of Freemasonry. Yep. And he was Noah's great-grandson. He helped invent cannibalism, child sacrifice, and his mother was his wife. He had incestuous relationships because they had ritualistic sex magic. Aleister Crowley, right? Where do you think he got it from? And he would receive illumination based on that. And that's why he had them mold a crown. He's the first king to wear a crown because a crown represents the sun and its rays. He was the first sun deity on record. He was also the first king to unify the world or have an old world order, and that's why the elite refer to the current administration as the new world order. The old world order was the mystery religion, the mystery Babylon religion, the symbolism, the occultism, the new age movement. And if you look at old Masonic texts, their magazine that used to come out every month was called the new age, put out by the 33rd degree council. So, you know, I'm not saying that all Masons are bad. I'm not saying all Knights Templar are Gnostic, you know, ball worshippers, but, you know, maybe they are. I just
honestly, as a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, that's my favorite. That's one of my favorite ones, is that they're involved with anything. Like, they're involved with nothing more than your local fish fry and a keg, dude. Like, they basically support Special Olympics. They put on Special Olympics events across the world. Like, well, that's
the Knights of Columbus were made to hunt the Knights Templar, weren't they? Isn't that the history?
Absolutely not. Absolutely.
Or is that the Knights of Columbus? I can't remember.
No, Knights of Columbus were founded in the early 1900s when Catholics were actively persecuted in America. Couldn't get life insurance, couldn't get jobs, things like that.
That's what the Knights of Columbus
are. It was a fraternal order because we weren't allowed to join Masons.
I don't know. It sounds Freemasonry to me.
We weren't allowed.
Just kidding.
I mean, there are some things that are definitely, as far as initiation go, that are there. But literally, it's one of those, like, No, dude, like they had evolved with nothing. They literally raised money for your local charities. They take care of vets. Like they march in parades.
Mormonism and Jehovah Witness are Masonic religions. Would you believe me? Because they are.
Yeah. No, I would absolutely understand that.
13 degrees of the watchtower, you know, and it's interesting that top Satanists back in the day in the 80s and 90s, they would tell their people to become Mormons because they shared a lot of the similar beliefs of occultism. And there's a lot of satanic Luciferians. And by satanic Luciferian, there's Luciferianism, then there's satanic Luciferianism. There's a difference.
And even the fact of the Lucis Trust. You went a rabbit hole, folks. And believe me, Kristen, a lot of my show, just so you know, a lot of my show, we talked about this privately. My show is here to help demystify topics for people. There's plenty of folks out there kicking up dirt, digging rabbit holes, making rabbit holes bigger. I'm like, this all happened near the pond. We all need to filter the water and start drinking the water at some point. So there are things out there, but like I've said, and like you've said, it doesn't mean that all of them are like that. All of them are
Exactly. I don't think that all Satanists are eating babies either, you know, but there are people out there that do really mess up things.
Oh, there are whacked out people all over the world, dude.
And who was it that was just on Rogan that was like,
I said it for years. Like, I'm a former Catholic seminarian. We believe some crazy stuff, man.
Well, you went to seminary. Where do you think seminary came from? It's all sex ritual, Solomon's Temple. It's all based on reproductive sex magic. You know, a lot of people don't realize that you went to a seminary. What is a seminary? What is a cardinal? Well, a cardinal is a hinge that opens doors. Opens doors to what? You got to start asking the questions to see where they lead.
I think there's a lot of pareidolia in there, but that just comes from actually being a seminarian and understanding what's going on. And once again, no secret society going on there, folks. None whatsoever.
Not in the Vatican. No. There'd never be any secret societies in the Vatican. They wouldn't call them the Jesuits either, you know.
Well, that's an order. That's their own thing, whatever. But I'm telling you right now, that is not the case at your local Catholic seminary.
I agree with you.
Full misunderstanding. So
I wouldn't think at your local Catholic seminary that usually that those kind of things go on. Although I have interviewed people that have been abused underneath the Vatican.
Oh, I know numerous people that have been abused. I know numerous people that have had horrible things happen to them in all kinds of places.
It's ties. It's like identical to the MKUltra satanic ritual abuse. It's like they have a program and they run it, no matter whether it's in Catholicism, Satanism, government programs. It's the same satanic ritual abuse. Or ritual abuse per se, and building those trauma bonds and split personalities and to control people's mind and lives. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I've been interviewing MKUltra survivors now for the last year, which is something that also I'm working on is a documentary. I'm trying to put together the very first, like, I think fully inclusive MKUltra documentary with survivors, and a lot of them have told me a lot of stories that will keep you up at night. They really will. It's right up there with you know, Sasquatch knocking on your front door, with Harry and the Hendersons just going in and scaring the bejesus out of you. I started going back to church after talking to a lot of these people. It's like, holy cow, this is crazy, and our government was in part of this. You know, the Naomi, MKUltra, Artichoke, Operation Looking Glass. We can dive into all the real government conspiracies that are really going on and not, you know, really speculate whether it's Masonic or not. But I can tell you, like, bad things do happen in secret societies, but there's a lot of great things that happen because of secret societies. And the Outlaws do Toy for Tots here in Wisconsin. So, you know, they must be good people. So, you know, it's just one of those things.
Well, it's the fact of, you know, not every chapter is involved in that kind of stuff.
But Battle Creek has swinger parties that they get busted for out there in Michigan. So who doesn't want to talk about that lodge? It's the party lodge. And, you know, we don't want to talk about the Order of the Jesters or, you know, anything else. So,
well, it's the fact that there are a lot of truths out there. There are a lot of facts, a lot of fiction. And whenever you get into, especially whenever you start diving into topics like what we were diving into at the beginning of this, giants, that kind of stuff. There is a lot of misunderstanding. There are a lot, and we have to remember also that during the time of many of those articles coming out. This was something that we've talked about before with our good friend Daniel Allen Jones, who has done tons of work into the Aurora case here in Texas. And it may very well be the case that the story of Aurora may have been written to reinvigorate people coming to Aurora. After the great boll weevil epidemic that decimated cotton crops and decimated things and stopped the railroad from coming through and things like that, it was a way for them to try and take part in the sensationalistic journalism that was going on in the late 1800s, early 1900s, things like that, to kind of make themselves a stop of local legend for people going by, to give themselves a point of interest again and to make themselves relevant when their economy had died, you know. So even the idea, and we've gotten into this with a gentleman just right up the road who is related to Jesse James and has proof of the fact that Jesse James faked his death, came to Texas, may have well brought treasure from the Knights of the Golden Circle to Texas and buried it, all kinds of things. And it's fascinating because, yeah, does it truly matter if he faked his, if we came to find out that he faked his death and came here, does it truly matter? The only people it really matters to is the town that claims his death. And the monument monument that they have that is the house where Jesse James was shot, where people come and pay tours and
There's something to be said about like truth seekers and being able to validate the truth.
Absolutely.
You know, it's like Davy Crockett, right? Did Davy Crockett really die or did he get out because he knew some Masonic handshake or gestures? You know, there's a lot of speculation there. And it's interesting, especially the thing that separates giant human skeletons. And I want to talk to you a little bit about Rockwall because you're in Texas. But, you know, there's a lot of collaboration here with scientists, with Smithsonian Institute, with legitimate like government agencies. And some of these giant skeletons aren't small. Some of them have been taped out 12, 15, 18 feet tall. One in Texas, yeah. I was looking for one in Texas, and here's one found in Austin, Texas. Have you been to Austin recently?
I live there.
Oh, okay. This says a giant skeleton 18 feet tall. If the reports of the fossilized skeleton of a giant 18 feet tall has been found near Seymour, Texas, is true, it is the most important ethnological discovery ever made in the world. Remarked by Dr. J.E. Pierce, professor of anthropology at the University of Texas. It would break all previous records of giants by nearly 10 feet. As the tallest man known to anthropological research, it was only 8 foot 5 inches, because it's an older one. This is like an 1860s, I believe. The skeleton is in possession of W.J. McKinney, a Houston, Texas oil prospector who found it, and he has been seen by a number of people who vouch for the truth of the size, the relic, and of course, if we scroll down, the Smithsonian, the bones were shipped to the Smithsonian Institute, of course, at the direction of Dr. J. Walter Fuchs, who was conducting the anthropological research work at the site. 18 feet tall. That's not a small dude. And, you know, like we mentioned, the Indians had, you know, legends of these tall giants eating their kids.
Well, I thought it was cool because not just eating their kids. Not just eating their kids. That may have been a preferred menu item. However, like
cattle?
the stories are actively of them having baskets on their back that would hold 2-3 people in it. That they would pick them up and throw them in a basket and carry them back underground where they lived in the cave. And that's how they ended up killing them in the cave, was they lived underground and the cave was their exit. So they barricaded them inside the cave and just burned the place. They went straight Freddy Krueger on them, man.
Well, a lot of these giants were involved with effigy mounds, too.
Oh, sure.
And burial mounds. And a lot of them were found there. Here's one from the New York Times published a story saying that in Georgia, the water has receded from the Tumlin Mound field and left uncovered acres of skulls and bones. Some of these are gigantic. If the whole frame is in proportion, it is a giant of 14 feet tall. Many curious ornaments of shells, brass, and stone have been found nearby. Some of the bodies were buried in vaults built of stones, the whole make of the mine of archaeological wealth. A representative from the Smithsonian Institution is here investigating the relics, of course.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, the stories of this and we're at the fact. Here's the big part is we're at the fact that giants never existed. It would be different, but we have actual relict skeletons of what are now called hobbits, the hobbit people that have been found down in the Philippines, stuff like that range no more than 3.5 feet tall. You know, we now have confirmed a couple of things, specifically Dragon Man, that it is not a fake, that it's actual DNA, it's a real skull. You know, that's 9.5 feet
tall. The Star Child.
You know, just all kinds of fascinating things like that. So there are cases of this. There are actual skeletons that we have. Are they a lot? No. However, we also don't have a lot that connect us and fully prove the theory of evolution. Hence why it's called the theory, not the law of evolution. You know, even the skeletons that we have of that, Lucy, things like that. When you look at Lucy, there is part of a jawbone, a few ribs, and a femur, and a few other sundry bones. It's not like we have a complete skeleton. It's not like we found a full body in that case. And that's something that's interesting to even think about is the dialogue of science when it comes to that, the repetition of that, of this being the fact. There's a lot that leans to that. Yes, don't get me wrong. However, that's why it's still called the theory, which means that there's a lot of room in there to wiggle, to move, to have other hypotheses within the theory.
Have you ever had Ken Hovind on? He's a very interesting dude.
No, Dr. I haven't. Dino.
You don't know Ken Hovind? He used to be known as Dr. Dino.
Yeah.
He's like the king of creation science, right? Mm. And I always like to hear both sides. And he does a really good job of poking holes in the theory of evolution. You know, obviously, the idea that it rained for millions of years on the rocks and then life came out of that is just not as scientifically sound as this planet being colonized by another race, which is essentially what every religious text talks about. There's all these planets out there, trillions of planets. There has to be life out there. They could have come here, spread life. That's way more mathematically sound than to think that we came from it raining on the rocks for billions or millions of years. What a millions of years we'd have to go with. You know, it's just one of those things.
It's tough, though, because even as a seminarian, former seminarian, it's the fact of, like we say on the show all the time, when you go out for investigation, period, you have to consider, so you have to have a very raw and real conversation with yourself. And I'll be talking about this at MUFON at the end of August.
Very cool. I used to be a member of MUFON. I used to be a field investigator. I didn't stick around long because
you have to have a very open and honest conversation with yourself at the beginning of every investigation as to why you are investigating this case. Are you investigating this case to confirm your personal belief, or are you investigating this case to confirm or disconfirm anomaly in a data set? And like that should peel it open right there, like immediately, as to how you're going to start looking at data that you are presented with. And even as a former seminarian, a person of faith, and somebody who joined the seminary off a religious experience, it doesn't change my religious experience if that experience is explained later in life. Doesn't change the question, doesn't change the way it changed me, doesn't remove any of that. So even the idea, and we have the conversation whenever we have folks from the Shakespeare Oxford Fellowship on, talking about, is Shakespeare Shakespeare as we know him? Love theater. It's how I got into my job. But is Shakespeare as we know him an actual person? Likely not. He's probably an amalgam of a few people. He's probably an amalgam of a few people.
Yeah.
Why does that matter? Why does it matter so deeply to academia to defend a person who may not, like, it's not going to strip the letters away from your name. It's not going to take away your body of work. You still did the work, and based on what we knew at the time, your work was friggin' sound. You know what I mean? So it's one of those, like, it's fascinating to see the reticence. It's kind of like, if I had Zahi Hawass on, the one question I would ask is why the continued push of the paradigm that the pyramids are a tomb? If they are, then whoever, by everything you say, according to their religious text, if they don't have those spells on the wall, they're going to be like the mummy in Brendan Fraser's The Mummy. They're going to be trapped there for all eternity. They're never moving anywhere. So what king were they trying to trap here and never let him leave without the spells to, like, have his heart weighed? So why is it that academia is so afraid to backstep and go, wait a minute, we need to rethink where we're coming from? Because, like, you keep saying that this thing's a tomb, but you also keep saying that you need these religious texts in order to be freed to the afterlife, but those texts are not in that tomb.
Yeah, anyway. How many sarcophaguses were found in the Egyptian pyramids there in Gaza, the big ones, or to the, not Gaza, excuse me, in Cairo?
Giza. Yeah,
Giza Plateau.
Yeah, no, exactly. None. There is a thing to maybe put a sarcophagus in if that's what it's for. But at the same time, where are the carvings? Where are the writings to get to launch that spirit into the nether realm?
Well, one thing we do know, if you've read Masonic texts, they did use the pyramids as a form of initiation for adepts.
Oh, sure.
Plato was initiated in the pyramids.
Yeah.
And in some of the more, the Gnostics believe Jesus Christ or Yeshua was initiated in the pyramids as well. But it's interesting when we talk about the pyramids. Manly P. Hall gave a whole presentation, and this is full circle now.
Yeah.
And I have the audio. It's based on Atlantis, but his understanding is that giants helped build the pyramids.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly. Exactly. And we have stories about that from all over, from Malta, where they say the giants built that. And there are the huge cart tracks that are two, three times the size of a cart that a regular person could carry or that we normally use. So
in the Philippines, they have the Cyclopean Castle and the Cyclopean walls because, you know, the Cyclops built those allegedly, you know?
Yeah, and that's just it. Once again, these are stories that go back through humanity.
Folklore.
These are things that reach, but at the same time, without folklore, and we talk about this with Ken Gerhard regularly with our good friend Ryan Edwards, cryptozoologist right up the road. Without folklore, we would not have the gorilla. Without folklore, we would not know about the Komodo dragon. We heard about those for 60, 70 years before science got interested in it, and it took them about 30, 40 years after getting interested in it to find them. You know? So it's one of those, if we listened to the people who these ain't just stories to, these are part of their history. It's not like, once again, the history of Lovelock Cave is not like a myth to the Paiute. That is a recorded part of their history.
You know, if I remember right, that story was that they barricaded the giants in and then they set the cave on fire, right?
Yeah,
and
they killed them. Yeah, and there is David Weatherly has great information on that. He's absolutely awesome. We should have him on at some point talking about that because he did research and found, like, the pictures of the lady with the dress, like made of the hair from it. And whenever you go into the cave, there is evidence of a massive fire having happened in there, more than just people like cooking.
I know somebody that's been in there too. Actually, I was just hanging out with Brad Olson at the beach week. You know, Brad's yes. an interesting guy. He's also used a lot. He didn't know he was using some of the clips I found, but he was also using a lot of the clips I found. I was like, I don't know if you know this, but like, you know, I never really brought, like, we've hung out at Contact and you know, I know him through Hugh Newman and Andrew Collins and my friend Apollo and a lot of other people. We all hang out whenever we see each other and we have these philosophical conversations. It's great to smoke a doobie and sit around the fire with those guys. It's always incredible. Nick Pope, all those guys. Nick Pope passed recently. But you know, it was one of those things where when you really start to go there, and Brad Olson, he was there, he went and found Lovelock Cave from my understanding, and he was saying some of the same things that you're saying right now. It's very interesting, the whole idea of giants. I would not be surprised if in the next 20 years, very large human remains are found. I mean, even the Smithsonian started writing articles about giants building things. They used to deny it. I once wrote the Smithsonian and I asked them what happened to all these skeletons, and I would attach, you know, articles to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, well, these skeletons were often mastodon skeletons.
Yeah.
And they were misdiagnosed as human giants because people didn't understand science. Then I followed up and I said, oh, wait, I gotcha. These were found in indigenous effigy mounds. At what point did the Indians live side by side with the mastodons in the last 2,000 years?
And bury them.
And bury them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what the response was?
Nothing.
They didn't get back to me.
Really big crickets.
They had nothing to say. They didn't get back to me. They had a witty explanation, but when I asked them a follow up question, they, you know,
yeah.
Jordan Maxwell used to always say, "Getting the right answer is getting the right question." You know, that's all. Halfway to getting the right answer is getting the right question to ask. And you know, a lot of times we don't put a lot of thought into the questions we need to ask. And you know, I always try to be witty and think and overthink sometimes. But I think the giant human phenomenon is one of those that is not going to go away. I think it's something that in history was accepted as fact for many years. I think we lost a lot of that in the last 1,000 years, maybe because a lot of these giant species are now dead. In fact, I think they say almost 93% of all life on this planet is extinct from its original origin. So we don't really know what existed, whether there was sprites and fairies and dwarves. And, you know, to John Todd used to always talk about how the Lord of the Rings is, a cult history, meaning they believe those things actually happened, that there really were trolls and that there really were hobbits and that there really was magic and things of that nature, and that J.R.R. Tolkien went to the Rothschilds church, the one that they went, and asked for permission to publish that data. And John Todd was the head of Zodiac Productions, which is like they were in charge of like 13 of the major record labels, and he was also born into the Collins family, one of the bloodlines of the Illuminati. And he would talk about how they would cast demons into the vinyl of albums that they thought would be big hits to help win souls, because at the end of the day, if you're the Illuminati, you have the money, you have the power. So what really matters at the end of the day is how many people, how many souls you can steal for the devil, per se. And it's a very interesting, you can go listen to those things. They're pretty interesting, some of the things he claimed. Again, I'm not saying those are my words or what I believe, but it's just all things
out there.
It's out there. It's interesting. It's data.
Well, and that's just it. And we speak about that regularly, just, you know, wrapping things for this segment, is the idea of taking data in, processing it, things like that. And even whenever you look at AI, that kind of stuff, I always say, despite anything trying to hack into something, whatever, folks, never mistake the fact that your average AI will be about as smart as the average person reading the internet. And that is because they are culling the data from the internet. They're getting the exact same trash that the person reading the internet will get. So if you're finding a bunch of trash articles, they're going to be finding it too, and that's why they hallucinate, and that's why they come up with things, and that's why that happens.
So Rockwell, know. What's your opinion before you let me go? Is it a real thing? Is it a miracle, that is a
natural formation, just natural as a
that's what I thought it would yeah, be too.
Yeah, yeah, and that's been like there have been numerous geological studies on it to show.
I know my buddy Scott Walter checked it out. I can't call him my buddy because I haven't talked to him in a long time, but we used to communicate because we have giant stone heads here in Wisconsin. Yeah, yeah. We got all sorts of neat stuff here.
Yep.
And I would send him stuff about all the pyramid mounds, and we communicate and talk. And I mean, he's been on the Rundown Live. And so if, you know, your listeners out there get a chance, absolutely, they can check out the Rundown Live. We do a lot of, you know, some of the stuff we do is a lot more darker and down the rabbit hole, but I'm always interested in hearing what other people have to say. And I have to say, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, Christopher. And
hey,
getting
absolutely
a chance to share my love of giant human skeletons with you. Because most people don't know that I'm the guy that, you know, 20 years ago was cutting up these, you know, Library of Congress articles and publishing them. And right? Now they're all over the place, but there's no way to really tie it back to me. But if you looked up my name, I'm going to do it right now. Let's see.
Yeah.
If you look up my name and giant human skeletons, there might be some remnants of, you know, hate, like Jason Calavito and all these top people. And there's some stuff here. Here it is. Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, a giant mystery, 18 strange skeletons found in Wisconsin. There I am, Cristanti Harris.
Yeah.
You know, there's the remnants of it. There I am on Coast to Coast AM and all these other things. But you can find some stuff back there to validate
that.
Yeah,
you're not even buried, bud. Like, that's right up there. That's right behind YouTube and Facebook right there with the Milwaukee Journal. So
yeah, I told you, man, I wasn't trying to pull a leg. I ruffled some feathers back in the day, and they'd probably like, why did we let this guy blog for us, you know?
The breeze is still blowing, man. You're still ruffling plenty. So,
you know, I don't write anymore. That's the crazy thing. There's no like aggregation. If I write a story, no one would read it.
Yeah.
Like, that's the crazy thing.
This is what it is now. Whenever
do you remember
it comes
that?
To that
getting
kind of
tens
stuff.
Of thousands of shares, and you'd be like, hell yeah!
Yeah.
Now it's like, yeah, that doesn't happen ever because it's crazy how social media has been built to really filter anything that they don't want you to hear.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I have to ask, why is it that they want everyone to just like starseed videos? Did you know that starseed videos accrue over a billion
views a year? I wouldn't doubt that.
People who are trans alien,
yeah,
they identify from coming from another planet, like, that's a real thing, and they're allowed to get billions of views. Why is it that our government allows that to get through? It's because that's what they want you to believe.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, thank you so much for your time, man. Truly, Kristen.
Yeah, it's been great. It's coming from Earth, just so everyone knows. It's
been super fun. We are definitely the place that they will be locking their doors as they pass. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Kristen, I can't tell you how much fun it was, how great it was to have you on. Thank you so much again. We'll be in touch with links, all that kind of good stuff, and we'd love to have you on again and again.
Anytime you want to have me on, I'm on, and I got other cool things to talk about, especially when it comes to secret societies. So I've done a lot of research. I'm one of the top experts on the subject. I've talked to a lot of great people from Masonry. I know people that are former Illuminati members. I know people are Knights Templar, and you know, we butt heads all the time, but I like to flex just to think that I win most of those arguments.
Right?
At least they're undeniable. You know, the facts are there. But it's how you look at the facts. Right, that's what they'll say. So
yeah, well, thank you once again for your time tonight. Thank you for the open, honest, and candid conversation. It's always
no problem,
great.
Christopher Jordan. I appreciate you having me on anytime. TheRundownLive.com. Find me at Spotify, Spreaker, Stitcher, anywhere where podcasts are found.
That's it.
And you can find me, I'm all over the internet right now.
And make sure to stop on by Facebook, folks, and follow Giantology. Follow his page there, and you know, check out all the great articles. Check out everything. Kristen, once again, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it. You have a great, great evening, man. We'll be in touch soon.
Yeah, no problem. Stay blessed, brother.
All right, you too. Wow, what a amazing conversation. That went places. And that is what it's about, is the conversation, folks. Like we always say, you've got to be able to have conversations with people. You've got to be able to court other thought forms. You've got to be able to accept other things into your data set and at least consider them, you know. Otherwise we live in a homogenous world, and I don't know if I just want vanilla on the shelf. You know what I mean? We have a lot of choices other than just a binary Coke or Pepsi. Go have a Fanta. Enjoy a root beer. You know what I mean? So when we come back from this quick commercial break, everybody, we will be joined by Sylvia Sterling. We will be learning about Lyrid aliens and their connection with your cat, my cat, all cats, what they are, why they're here. Like, why are cats here? Why do they choose us? Not just us choosing them. And what is that connection about? Cat whisperer and Lyrid alien expert, Sylvia Sterling, right after this, folks.
The key to good science is good research. At the heart of good research is a good data set. With the field observation and encounter log from Curious Research, you can easily keep track of your investigative information all in one place, making it easier to review cases and readily see comparisons and contrasts between them. Whether out in the woods squatching, in a back room gathering EVPs, or using high-tech gear to track UFO UAP activity, this easy-to-carry, pocket-sized scientific data log is the perfect companion for any field researcher. You can find your copy of the Curious Research Field Observation and Encounter Log at Amazon.com or visit the official Curious Realm store at CuriousRealm.com/store to reserve your copy for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is CuriousRealm.com/store.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome back from that quick commercial break. Thank you so much for staying with us. Also, thank you so much to our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science. If you're a user of CBD products like I am, stop on by TrueHempScience.com today. Christopher Lynch and True Hemp Science use a spigeric process where every part of the hemp plant is used, and that's every part, folks. Seeds, stems, buds, roots, fibers. Every part of the plant is used, reused, combusted, and reused, and that process followed time and time again. Still an amazing spigeric product result. Stop on by, check them out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. I have used True Hemp Science and Christopher Lynch's stuff for at least the last 5 years, and it is amazing. I've been all over the country to dispensaries everywhere, folks. Unless there's like THC fully involved, you ain't gonna find something better than this. Stop on by, check it out. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. While you're there, make sure to stop on by the website of our guest for this segment, Sylvie Sterling. She is a Lyran starseed. We will get into that in just a moment. And also a cosmic cat whisperer. I am fascinated by the idea of animal whispering to begin with. The idea of animal communication was something that I studied for a little while in abnormal psychology. We had to go, and most of it was really more primate observation, Sylvie. But amongst that was, how are they communicating? In what way are they socially communicating? What are their social cues to each other? Things like that. And when you start looking at the ways that animals communicate, specifically amongst each other, you really start to break down a lot of how humans interact, because we are by nature animal. So a lot of our preternatural ways are very animalistic in that kind of way. Let's start off, because your Lyran starseed participation is also what connects you to cats, and in this cat whispering way. So how did you first find out that you were a Lyran starseed, Sylvie?
Wow, that's a lot of questions. Where do we start? I found out, well, I always had a very deep connection with cats. I always felt like I didn't fit in when I was little, when I was growing up. I always felt different. I felt just like many starseeds, just at the time I grew up in the 70s, nobody talked about starseeds. So I always felt different, and I always had a very special connection to cats. I grew up with cats and dogs, and I had cats were my people. I felt very, very much connected to them. And it took me 40-something, 50 years almost, to find out that I was a Lyran starseed. My Lyran star family connected to me through a cat. I was, at the time, I wasn't communicating with cats yet, but I had learned how to meditate, and I was visiting a friend's house, and she had a cat, and the cat sat down on the couch, and the cat started to communicate with me. You know, a cat, sometimes they stare at you, yeah, and you don't know. You have the feeling they're trying to say something. So this cat sat there and stared at me, and she stared and she stared. And I said, I think something wants to come through this cat. So I sat down, I closed my eyes, I tuned in, and it turned out it wasn't the cat trying to talk to me. It was my Lyran star family. There were channeling through the cat, and they told me I was a Lyran starseed, and they told me they were the lion beings. They said I was one of them, and they said my mission is to work with cats and to tell people, humans, that cats come into our lives with a purpose, that cats work with us, cats help us on our soul path, and basically it's all about purpose, and I'm supposed to teach the purpose of cats and how cats help us with our spiritual awakening and our soul path. And I came out of the channeling and I said, what just happened? I had never heard of the lion beings before. It resonated very much that I was a starseed, that I was not from here, that I was not a human. I was a lion being in a human body. And I went to the computer and I Googled lion beings. And I was very relieved. I said, oh, my God, it's actually a thing. People talk about this. And that's how I learned about them. And I've been in contact with them ever since. And they've been guiding me ever since.
And this communication specifically, because once again, it was a higher consciousness coming through the cat to you. Yes. Since then, is the communication now, is all communication that comes to you through the feline species, Lyran in origin?
That's a good question. I can receive information from everyone or anyone out there in the ether, in the spiritual realm, but mostly, yes, I'm being guided by my Lyran star family, by the cats. I channel the cats.
Okay.
Like other people channel the angels or interdimensionals or ETs or,
sure,
or ascended masters. The cats actually started to channel through me. They channel an entire book to me. They give me all kinds of information. But most everything that comes through the cats or the cat people, the Lyrans. Interesting is when I work with people, I also work with humans. I'm an ascension guide for humans as well, but I work with them through their cats. And when I tap into people, it's usually their cats come in and they give me information about their humans. Their cats know exactly what their human needs, where their human is stuck, where their human is not aligned, where their human needs help. They need, you know, they channel information for their humans through me.
And, you know, it's interesting because I have always said, I'm a huge reptile fiend. I love reptiles, amphibians, mm-hmm, things like that, Sylvie. However, personally, when people ask me, am I a cat or a dog person? I will always say cat person. Mm-hmm. And I say that because I normally say that with the caveat of it's because a cat's love doesn't suppose. You know, there is kind of an imposition sometimes of a dog's want of attention or affection or love. And that just kind of imposes on my life as a human. Most of the times it really seems as though the two cats that we have in our house would be perfectly fine if I was not there.
That's funny you should say that, but that's actually a misconception.
Absolutely.
Cats love their humans very much. They just have a different way of showing it, and they work with you in different ways. And that's what I teach. I talk about the 12 cat archetypes, the 12 main cat purposes with humans. Some cats are healers, some cats are energy workers, some cats are mirrors, some cats are joy bringers, muses, and they work with us in different ways. They're very subtle in that. And some cats are actually muses, and the muses are, they show us how, they are the independent cats, the free-spirited cats. Mm. And they basically teach us, be more like a cat. Don't care about what other people say. Be your own person. Be independent. Don't need anyone. Don't need approval, right? Well, so that's why some cats are so standoffish. They are teaching us to be our own person, to not need anybody's approval, to not try to please anybody.
Well, and you know, that is the one thing that I will that I always say about cats, and one of the reasons that I love them is because A, we domesticated cats before we domesticated dog, and that's fascinating to think about, that we have had domestic cats, and cats were worshipped. Very few dog cults in the world, you know, very few. Religious societies believing that dogs were higher or a spiritual being, whereas cats all over the place. Very, absolutely, very fascinating to see that, number one. Yeah. Number two, the fact of a couple thousand years, most dogs that you see, we have bred into what they are, and that's happened within the last 500-600 years. We have domesticated cats for the last 2,000 years. And the only thing we've really changed is some of their coat. We haven't like bred cats specifically because they are a great mouser in that kind of way, you know, like a bull terrier or something like that. Because a cat won't be tamed in that kind of way. They are here to amuse you like that. There is a beautiful mutual relationship. And yes, the fact is, if you are accepted by a cat, that is the highest compliment of all. If your cat is one that comes and greets you at the door, that is one of the hugest compliments that there is, that the cat even came out of its state of comatoseness, relaxed in the dark, wherever it was, to come greet you, is a huge, huge thing. And that's just it. Like you said, the ways that they communicate are different than a dog. A dog gives very, very clear signals about like, hey, pat my head. And cats do too. But it's interesting, even the idea of a meow of communication. Cats by instinct do not meow beyond the point of weaning. Once they're done weaning, like it's quiet time now because we're stalking in the wild. You know, we don't meow for communication, things like that. We have silent forms of communication as cats. So that meow is very interesting that they would even attempt communication with us.
That's the thing. They do not meow with each other.
Yeah.
They never meow with each other. They usually communicate telepathically, but also with their body posture, language, right? But they started meowing basically for us because they realized we talk verbally. So they were trying to establish communication with us, and they started to mimic us, and that is how they started meowing. It's really interesting.
Yeah.
And I wanted to say to your previous point, actually, cats domesticated themselves. We never domesticated cats. Isn't it interesting that all other animals got domesticated? The cows and the sheep and all the farm animals, right? We kind of domesticated them.
Yeah.
The dogs, we domesticated them. We were teaching them what to do. We're teaching them tricks. We closed them in. The cats are the only species that came out of their own free decision. They came to stay with us about 10,000 years ago. When humans in this civilization started farming and agriculture and settling down, And then the cats came to, because we had a food supply. We had rodents coming into our grain chambers because we started to store grain. And the cats came and found the mice in the grain chambers. And then the humans started to realize that there is these predators and they come in and they take care of the mice. So after a while, humans and cats started to form a bond because it was a mutual partnership. But humans, usually they did not try to domesticate cats. Cats would come into their dwellings. They would sit with them in the evenings. And then humans would realize how the purring filled the room and how the presence of the cat was very soothing and calming. And it was more of a friendship that started to grow. It was not that we domesticated them. And to this day, the cat is the only animal we don't expect them to do anything for us. We get a cat because we love their company, but we don't expect them to protect the house. We don't expect them to carry us like a horse, right? Or we don't expect them to protect the family. We get dogs, horses, all other animals with a special purpose in mind.
Yeah.
We get cats because we just love to have them around. We don't expect anything. So they are the only animals that we have just for company and just for joy. They don't have to do anything. And yet they do so much for us, but it's a mutual relationship. It's not I bring you my house and I expect you to do this, right?
Yeah.
So they never got domesticated. They formed a friendship with us.
And that is once again, a fascinating friendship when you start getting into it, even the bonds that are created. I have a 9-year-old son, and the eldest cat that we have in our house right now, Floyd, my son found. He was a small kitten. He lived in what we called the murder shack. It was just this tiny little shack with like 3.5 walls that was in our backyard in South Austin at our old house. Son was playing outside one day and heard a kitten. Looked inside the shack, and there it was, abandoned by mom. We'd seen Mama Cat a few times. We'd seen her with her kittens, things like that. We waited. Nothing happened. We brought Floyd in. That cat has been bonded entirely to my son since then, to the point that comes in and sits with him at story time at night. Stays with him till he goes to sleep, things like that. Waits for him to come home from school, you know, things that a dog would typically do. And it is fascinating to see. I personally had a cat in Maine, Morpheus, that was awesome. He would play fetch with me. He would play hide and seek with me. Come when he was called. All kinds of wild things. And even he would bring me presents. My old cat, who I had rescued, she was called Cat because I didn't want to get attached. Then by that point I was attached, so she was just Cat. But she would actively bring me live butterflies. That was like the huntress of huntresses. It's like, how did you even not kill this butterfly, getting it into your mouth and bringing it to me? But I think that is one of the most interesting behaviors is that share of kill in that kind of way, because that is truly, that is a pride mentality at that point. You know, that's something that no different than lionesses sharing a kill with a pride, something like that.
You know what they want to show with that many times? They're showing us, be proud of who you are, embrace your shadow side.
Interesting.
My late cat, Lisa, she was a very fierce huntress. She was a very sweet cat, but she was a fierce hunter. She was a muse. Her archetype was a muse. That was her purpose, to basically teach me to stand up and be proud and be who I am, right? And in her later years, she would become fiercer and fiercer with the hunting, and she would always bring the mice, and she would always put the mice at my doorstep, and I hated that. But she was teaching me, this is who I am. I have the soft side, I have the sweet side, but I also have a shadow side. And she was teaching me to embrace your shadow side, be who you are, be proud of who you are. And many cats do that for that reason.
Now, the 12 archetypes, let's get into that real quick. What are the archetypes of cat being in that kind of way, Sylvie?
Well, some cats are healers. They come to you to heal you. They have a certain frequency. They emit. They lie on you. They sit with you. And they heal you, body, mind, and soul. Some cats are supporters, like Floyd, your cat, your boy's cat that you just... that you just described, he's a supporter. Those are the ones, they are very much like dogs. They sit with us, they spend time with us, they support us emotionally and physically. There's cats that are muses. They show us who we stand up for, who you are, be who you are. Some cats are energy workers. They're cleansing our rooms and us humans on an energetic level. Some cats are joy bringers. Some cats are lovers. Some cats are rebels. They show us where we need, where our life is not aligned, where we are not living our best life. Some cats are teachers. And I don't want to go deep into all of them, but some cats are mirrors. These are very, very important. There are mini me's. They show where we are not aligned. And that's how every cat has a special task with they're human, and it's not really their job. It's who they are. That's why I call them archetypes. It's the truth of who they are. And they know exactly what they do, which is really interesting. You know how most people spend half their life searching for their life purpose? Hmm. What am I here to do? I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. Cats know it instinctively. Even little kittens, and I've spoken to little kittens, no more than 2 weeks old, they know exactly who they are. They know exactly what their archetype is. They say, I'm a healer, and I'm going to be here healing my person. I haven't found my person yet, but I know I'm going to be a great healer for my person. They know exactly who they are.
Now, when it comes to that intention of a cat, the way in which they, I guess, bring that archetype to be, with their person. How do they go about doing that? And how is that expressed? What messages might the average person be missing from their furry friend?
Mm-hmm. So let's say the healers, that one's very straightforward, right? Everybody can imagine what a healer cat is. They will lie wherever they lie on you, which body part they sleep on. That is where they're healing you. So if you have a cat that sleeps by your feet at night or sits by your feet a lot, they are grounding you. They are healing your connection to the earth. They are lying next to your throat or next to your head. They are cleaning your throat chakra. If they are lying on your heart or on your chest, they are sending you healing for the heart. So look out for where your cat sleeps, where your cat sits next to you. That is where you are not aligned. That is where they're working with you. Or let's say the mirror cats, they are your mini-me. They are your reflection. They likely have the same issues, life topics that you have. If you have a cat that's very shy, very scaredy cat, always runs away when people come in the house, they are showing you that you are not comfortable with people. You are hiding from the world. When you have a cat that is scratching or biting, they are usually mirroring a person who is angry at the world, who is upset, who lashes out at people. When you have two cats fighting, they are usually showing me they are mirroring their humans. They're reflecting their humans' relationship. Their humans are fighting with each other. Their humans have closed doors between them. So the cat's behaviors are very much tied to us. They're very much a reflection of us. And it's always a message. When a cat behaves funny, when a cat behaves weird, it's always a message to their humans. And I always say, just feel in. Where do you feel that? Where, you know, what is your cat doing that mirrors you? It's really interesting how that works.
Well, and, you know, Floyd, we have two cats in the house right now, Roscoe and Floyd. Roscoe is a rambunctious year and a half old. He definitely picks on his older brother. And there are times where Floyd has just had enough and lets him know. But there was a very interesting trait that Floyd picked up. And he picked that up because he was never a lap cat. He is still to this day not like a Roscoe will let you pick him right up, snuggle him. He'll just go limp and enjoy the moment. Floyd has to go. He doesn't want to be held. He's not, if he cuddles, it's on his term. But he was not a cuddle cat. He was not a lap cat. He would cuddle near you, like on a blanket or something, but he was not a lap cat until my wife's cat, Leon, passed about a year ago, year and a half ago. And he passed at home, and Floyd was there when it happened. And Leon had come into my wife's life when her father was passing. And very much filled. I lived in Houston at the time. She lived here in Austin. That cat got every bit of her love that was spare. And from the time that he was a small kitten, would crawl up on her shoulder for love and just drool all over her. And until the day he was like a 20-pound adult who was almost 12, 13 years old, he did that. And it was very interesting to see Floyd there as Leon passed, as he crossed. And then to see him within 48 hours start climbing up on my wife.
Because she needed it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was sometimes, it was fascinating to see that behavior pick up, because he didn't cuddle with me. He comes and lays between my legs every night now. But until then, he did not. It was almost like, that's not my place. It was very interesting.
It was not his task. It was not his job. And sometimes when cats leave us and they're very much missed or they leave a gap, the other cats sometimes step up to the task and they say, I'm going to take over the task because my person needs that. And then they start the cuddling. I think it's beautiful that Floyd stepped up.
He did.
To that.
And we very much gave him his time as well. Because I'd had my cat who passed probably about a year and a half before Leon. And Floyd knew her and was brought up by her. But to see him pick up those mannerisms and to see him start doing that was very, very interesting, because he was not that way at all. And is totally now. He completely, like you said, took up that mantle of, well, this is what they need. And it's interesting to see that.
The cats, usually they share their humans and they share responsibilities. They say, this is your job, this is my job, right? But they can cross over and they can jump into the gap, basically, that the cat that leaves fills for them. It's also important to know that the cats across over, they are still with us. They are still helping us from the other side. And the cats that we have on this side of the veil, they are working together and they're communicating with each other.
And how does that communication take place, Sylvie? How do we know? Because, there are definite times, because my cat, was very much a studio cat. She would be with me, like sitting here with my synthesizers while I would make music, things like that. Leon was not necessarily like that. Floyd comes and sits on top of my computer right here next to me while I work. But Cat was very much, like you said, like a muse of a cat. She was always in the midst when creation was happening.
And
was a very important moving part of me getting moving, creating again when I moved home from Maine and adopted her from the wild. So that idea of communication, these things being carried forward from one to another? How does that, I guess, onus or responsibility get communicated? Amongst the pride of animals, because at one point there were three, you know, so I guess how does she mama cat the young one and make him understand what his place is, and how do they understand their mutual place amongst each other, and how does that get passed on?
They communicate telepathically. They communicate all the time. They communicate on a soul level, and they usually share the responsibilities. So it's like a mutual understanding between them. When a new cat comes into the family, yes, sometimes there's friction when a new cat comes into the family.
Oh, sure.
But if you understand that you're, let's say you're two existing cats, one is a lover, one is a healer, and then the third cat comes in, and the universe will always send you the right cat. So the cats will naturally gravitate towards what they do best. And when you explain to them, this is the new cat now, and he's a healer. He's doing something completely different. You're not going to, you know, step on each other's toes. They are sharing you, and everybody does what they do best for you and with you. And the interesting thing is the universe always sends us the right cat. The universe always sends you the cat that you need at that point in your life. So it's not likely that you'll have friction between the cats, usually, because the universe will not send you three healer cats unless you're in dire need of healing, right? So they will usually find their place. And it's like an unspoken rule between the cats that everybody does what they do best. And if you are aware of what your cats do for you, I find that really helps.
Mm.
Because when I first started out 10 years ago as a cat behaviorist, I would talk very much about the earthly stuff, right? I got a degree in cat behaviorism, and I started to just counsel people on normal cat stuff.
Sure.
Right? And so many people called me about their cats not getting along, and they would come in the home and look at it and then see the cats interact. That was before I had all that knowledge from communication that I have now. But I very early on realized how important it is for humans to know this cat is a healer, this cat is a lover, this cat is a muse. And when you are aware of what your cats do for you, then the cats get along better usually, because you are aware, okay, this is my muse. My muse has to come and sit with me when I do my music or my writing, right?
Yeah.
And then in the evening, I'm going to have my lover cat sit with me. When I'm on the couch relaxing, I'm going to need that lover or joy bringer being all over me, right? So when you realize what your cats are doing, the cats usually get along better, because now they have their time with you, because now you understand the time that you spend with them. So being aware of your cat's purpose really helps with the cats getting along. And then it becomes very frictionless usually.
Yeah. And, you know, the greeting is one that I've been, oddly, in the last year and a half, really since Leon has passed, I have really gotten into the idea of cat communication and how they, once again, to see Floyd flip and become something that he totally wasn't before and have mannerisms and activities that he didn't have before, fascinated me. And that's when I found out about the idea, the meow of communication and the fact that, like, no, that really is unique. And if your cat is me, and I've always, you know, just joyfully said to them, well, use your words, talk to me, you know, and they do. And it's interesting because, like, Floyd is obsessed with water. As is Roscoe, but Roscoe is much more obsessed with watching water go down sinks, whereas Floyd is obsessed with, like, drinking from the faucet, despite the fact that he has an eternal fountain of fresh water in the kitchen. He specifically asks and meows differently for water than for anything else, and will sit by the sink and meow. And even the idea of a cat asking you for something is another one where it's like, that is a huge point of compliment. Because as opposed to a dog, things like that, that basically came to us because we had scraps, you know, things like that was a full-on mutual benefit relationship. We got guardianship during the night, things like that. Once again, you aren't really expecting your cat to wake you up when danger happens necessarily. Like, that's not what they're there for, you know, and that's a fully understood. Like, would I be impressed if my cat came and woke me up if there was a fire? Pardon my language, but hell yes. I would be very surprised, because that's not their preternatural thing to do in that kind of way. Whereas a dog's job is to alert, you know, so seeing those things and understanding those behaviors. And once again, the idea, like you're saying, that they're rooted on a different level than just genetic in that kind of way, that they're rooted on a soul level, and they are rooted on a level of what their defined purpose is.
Yes, absolutely. Did you know that cats understand everything that we say, though, verbally? That's something many people don't really realize. They understand everything. I always say, talk to your cat in your normal voice. Because people, they come and they want to learn animal communication, and I teach that, and I'm rooting for that, for everybody to learn animal communication, because it gives you such a rich insight into what your cat really wants and needs. But they do understand our words. They understand when we talk with our regular normal voice. So I always say, talk to your cat in your normal voice, and they will understand everything that we say, and we underestimate that. So I always say, you know, when you take the cat to the vet and you're talking in front of the cat about we need to put this cat down or not, you know, be cautious, be aware that they understand everything that you say.
Yeah.
So that's a way to communicate with your cat. You won't hear them back, but they hear everything that you want to tell them.
Well, is there a way that we can hear them back? Is there some sort of subtle communication that we are missing in some kind of way, be it even like prime example would be bunting when somebody comes back home. Yes, that is a sign and a show of affection, but it's also the fact of they are basically marking you as safe again. Like, you went out into the world, you went out into this crazy place, man. And you had a rough time, and I hope you're okay. It seems like you're okay. I'm here to, like, remark you with scent so that you know you're safe and okay. All right. And even understanding that, you know, even understanding bunting in a different way, that it goes beyond the point of them being affectionate. It's the fact of they're trying to reassure you that no, you're here and you're safe now. It's okay.
Body language is a big thing for cats. So yeah, if we start to understand their body language better, that's a way of them communicating with us. It's just many times it's so subtle that people don't understand what the cat's body language means. But just watch their behavior. Their behavior is talking to you all the time, as I said. It's so funny because you said earlier about the snuggling and the cuddling and all these things. There's so many people who think my cat needs affection. My cat needs all this attention. My cat always cuddles with me at the most inopportune times. I need to go. I need to leave. I need to finish my work project. And my cat just keeps cuddling, and my cat doesn't want to leave my lap. The thing is, people think that their cat is clingy. But in most cases, the cat is trying to tell the person, you are...
Slow down.
Slow down. Exactly. I had so many people, I mean, now after COVID, a lot of people are doing home office now, right?
Or
during COVID. It was so funny because I had so many people contacting me during COVID, and they were doing home office, and they said, my cat is so clingy, and my cat doesn't want me. My cat's always jumping on my computer and my keyboard, and I can't work, and why does my cat need so much affection? And then when I tune into the cats, they said, no, it's my human. My human hates the job.
They're freaky,
my human
man.
Hates the project. My human, I'm trying to calm him down. I had Once I had a lady who said that her cat would always sit in front of the camera during a Zoom call, and he would always position himself right in front of the camera. And it was starting to be embarrassing because a colleague said, right, your cat's always sitting there. And so I asked the cat, and the cat showed me that my human is uncomfortable in front of the camera. So the cat was trying to help out.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Block no, the totally.
So the lady
totally.
Doesn't have to be uncomfortable. And they do these things, and we need to learn that they don't do that by accident. They don't do that because they're clingy, because they're silly, because they're, or when a cat knocks down your computer mouse, right?
Yep.
They're telling you to take a break.
Yeah. I explain that to my wife sometimes. They are communicating with you the best they can.
Yes.
You know, when that cat comes and greets you, stop and say hi. Give it that moment. Like, give it. It's 5 seconds out of your life as a human being that means the world to that cat, because it now understands that you understand. Like you said, like it fully gets it. It understands. It understands beyond your words what you're saying, what you're feeling, and what you're saying is a lie, and what you're belying to it is a lie.
They're trying to calm us down. Yeah. They're trying to take us to force us to take breaks, to come into the moment. When your cat greets you, or wants to sit with you, or wants to sit on you, or gets all over you, many times they just want to take a break, slow down, breathe. Mm-hmm. Just take a second. So when your cat does that, really take that few seconds. Take a breather. And so it's so much more than just them, you know, trying to get attention or saying hello. It's even more than that. They are trying to slow us down because they understand we have a hectic life and they're not here to tell us not to do these things. They understand we have a busy lifestyle. They understand we have things to do that they don't, right? All these social things that we have to do and jobs. They understand all that, but they step in when they see we get overworked, overwhelmed, we're running all the time. They will step in, they will tell us to slow down if we just know how to take the hint.
Well, and those hints, once again, come in interesting ways. We'll get into both of the cats in my house right now are orange cats, which are just a special breed of crazy in and of themselves, not only just with water obsessions and just their curiosity and wanting to open drawers and get into things. It's hilarious. But one of the questions that I had that came from somebody was they have a cat who they've had for years. They have a split floor home, and 10 o'clock is apparently the cat's decided bedtime. And it's like, whether we're tired or not, it's bedtime, and the cat will run riot. He will go crazy. He will yell. We'll do everything in the world until we go to bed. And once we go upstairs, cool. Bed. Does he stay with them in the bed? No, Sylvie.
He just tries to get them to.
No, just
to calm down, to settle down, get their sleep. You know, the cat might also try to get him off the television. I don't know what they do, but usually people watch TV in the evening or at the computer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what they watch. Ask them what they watch in the evening, what their cat is trying to get them away from. They understand we're watching content that's not good for us, right? Hey,
absolutely. Absolutely.
I once had a client who said her cat... I was doing a session with her cat, and her cat said, there's bad energy coming out of that box, out of the TV. There's really bad energy coming out of there, and she needs to stop that. So I asked the client afterwards, I said...
24-hour news cycle?
I said, what are you watching? She said, oh, I like to watch these forensic shows and the crime shows where people get killed and slaughtered.
Special victims unit marathons.
Exactly. Yeah. And I said, you can't stop that. There's bad energy coming out of that thing. So she stopped, and they both lived a happy life. But yeah, absolutely. So whoever asked that question.
That's my cousin. That's my cousin, Ricky. That one's for you, Ricky. Whatever y'all are watching over there, man, take it into consideration. And one of my questions, and this has to do with Floyd. Floyd, I refer to Floyd as our $6 million cat. We had a scare with him a few years ago with his kidneys. Had to spend quite a few $1,000s. He's now on a specialized diet, all kinds of things. But he's doing great. He's fantastic. I knew he was sick because another interesting trait about Floyd is his tail wags like a dog's.
Uh-huh.
It is literally like to the point that his brother plays with it and he gets pissed at his brother for like, hey, dude, seriously, I'm just thinking. Like, leave me alone. But his tail has a mind of its own and moves on its own. And when his tail wasn't wagging for a whole day, I was like, something is wrong. Something is off with this cat. And we took him to the vet, and sure enough, it was kidneys, and we had him fixed. But before then, even Sylvie, we had two litter boxes in our house. Two cats, two litter boxes. Okay. Even before then, Floyd will not use the litter, but he uses a corner. And it's pretty much the same corner all the time. Cats are typically pretty good about that. They're at least organized in that kind of fashion. But even since Leon, Roscoe has no problem. He's the king of two litter boxes, man. His domain is wide. But it's fascinating that doesn't matter what we do. He'll go into the litter box, things like that, but he always returns to the corner.
So my question is, why don't you put a litter box in that corner?
Well, that's a really good question. We should.
That's a spot. Put a litter box there.
That's solved. Yeah, that's a good thought, and I haven't really considered that, and I should. I will have to relocate my son's piano, where he practices piano.
Just move it over a little bit.
But yeah, that is, and why have I not listened to the cat? Obviously, the cat enjoys using that corner.
But are you saying that he goes to the bathroom under the piano?
Near the piano, right next to it. Yeah.
What's going on the piano? Who has stress playing the piano?
I don't know that anybody has stress playing piano.
That's a question you need to ask. Because the cat continuously pees in a certain spot, there's usually stress or pressure in that spot. Mm. I've had cats pee in front of the bathroom mirror, and it turned out that their human was very much focused on their looks, and they had stress in the morning getting ready. How do I look? Oh, my God, I have a wrinkle.
Interesting.
Or I had cats pee, one cat pee in front of a teenage daughter's closet. And it turned out the teenage daughter had stress in front of her closet in the morning. What am I going to wear? Do I look fat in that? Do I look good in that? Will my classmates like that? Huh. So who has stress with that piano?
Interesting. I'll have to bring that up with my son. He mm-hmm. practices piano there every day. As far as I know, that's just it. I am a self-taught musician. Mm-hmm. I couldn't abide most lessons that I did take. So it was one of those. I try to make piano fun for him. I try to make it enjoyable. I don't make it stressful. On occasion, I'll tease him about it, be like, hey, I haven't heard that piano mm-hmm. today, buddy. But he gets over there. He creates. He does all kinds of music mm-hmm. on the piano. He hits record and makes his own music. So I'll have to ask him if any of the piano is a point of stress to him in that kind of way.
Yeah, I'm just putting it out there. I'm not saying that's what it is,
absolutely.
But maybe, you say you're a musician.
Yeah.
Maybe he's putting himself under pressure. I have to be as good as dad. I'll never be as good as dad. I'll never live up to my own expectations, your expectations.
That's true.
Whatever it is, just ask him in a quiet moment. Yeah. Does he have, what kind of stress pressure does he have with that piano? And or put a litter box next to it. And I was still trying to do that.
I will definitely start putting the litter box next to it.
Look into that.
Yeah.
Look into that. Who has stress and pressure? And if he then changes, if Floyd changes the position, he pees next to the litter box out of the piano, then you have your answer. It's not the corner. It's whoever has stress in that corner with that piano.
Interesting. And once again, this is a behavior that happens with numerous animals, especially whenever they come to new places, things like that. And it was fascinating to me that it just started one day. and has continued and has continued. We hoped, again, we honestly thought, and poor old Leon, we blamed the old man in the house for the longest time till we actively caught Floyd mm-hmm. in the midst of it. And it was like, hey man, like seriously?
Well, we already established Floyd is your son's supporter.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
interesting.
Just look into it.
I will. Thank you for this.
Out of that. Yeah.
And you know, when it comes to things like that, now that you mention that seems like one of the most logical things in the world. Even the idea of like, well, why haven't you put a litter box there? And of course, as a human being, it's like, well, because it's like an open room. Hey, if I had a whole cross draft of friends coming over to play bridge three times a week, whatever, that'd be different. I have one day a week where somebody comes over and teaches my son piano.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Oh, okay. So, does it, I mean, it could also be that person coming in has a bad energy or has a has a very, you know, brings in a lot of stuff. I mean, some sure. people, when they come into a home, they bring in emotional stuff, and some cats are very sensitive to that, or they try to protect their humans from people coming in with their emotional stuff, and it always kind of rubs off, right? So I don't know. I don't know that person. I don't want to offend anybody.
No,
when people come into our homes, cats are very sensitive to homes, and they react to people's energy.
Yeah.
So just something else to think about.
Well, and that is quite literally a topic that we bring up on the show all the time. Because I guess in a lot of mediumship, things like that, it's called shadow work. You know, mm-hmm. the idea of like, no, watch your energy. Because like you are directly responsible for whatever energy you bring into a room, you know, and that's what that shadow work is for, is recognizing like, yeah, hey, you know, no different than in a yogic principle, anger is a good thing. Anger is righteous. It's great. That's where a sense of justice comes from, is anger, but you're not supposed to give it safe harbor and food and shelter. You're supposed to acknowledge it and then go, okay, now what do I do to change that situation? Not live in anger, you know? So that idea of recognizing those energies and recognizing the fact that we are responsible for what we bring into a house. And my buddy who teaches piano is one of the most amazing people in the world. But yeah, has had some things happen over the last year or so. So I'm sure he is carrying, and I know he is carrying a lot of weight that he doesn't talk about, because we all carry a lot of weight that we don't talk about, you know?
Absolutely.
So yeah, maybe it's time for me to check in on my buddy too, you know? So there's a couple messages there to check into that Floyd is possibly giving me. Either my kid is subconsciously stressed in some kind of way, or the people who spend time in that room are stressed in some kind of way, and no different than him marking us and remarking us whenever we come in from the unsafe world back to a point of safety. He is trying to, he can only mark that spot with his face so much, man. Yeah, you know what I mean? Sometimes it requires a much larger marker than what the facial glands of a cat can provide, I suppose. Yeah.
And it's all for the good. The messages are always for us to look into something. It's, cats never do anything out of spite, and it's just so important. I mean, not you, but other people, they get angry when their cat pees in certain places, and they think my cat wants to punish me because I'm not home or something. Nothing could be further from the truth. When a cat pees, it's always a message, and they can speak to you, right? You don't hear what they have to say, so they have to show you in a different way, and it's always a message for us. Hey, there's something you need, something that needs aligning, something that is off. And they never do anything out of spite. And it's always when we learn to listen to the message, you say, oh, okay, well, maybe I should do a check-in with my buddy, with my son, right?
Yeah.
With my own, you know, whatever the check-in needs. It's always an uplifting, positive message for us to check something, to check into us.
Does the cat understand my sarcasm?
Yes.
Okay. As long as the cat gets my sarcasm whenever I'm like, you know, jokingly admonishing the boy about the piano, because, you know, I only jokingly do it. I don't really care if he practices piano every day. He's already a much better musician than I am. And I tell him all the time, it's like, boy, you don't understand. You already read notes on the staff and understand music and music theory 5 times better than your father does. So you will be amazing one day. But yeah, even the idea though of the cat understanding the fact of no, yes, that's dad's joking voice, not dad's serious voice. And once again, the idea of speaking, you don't have to give your cat baby talk. You don't have to talk to your cat as though, and you shouldn't even talk to a 1 year old that way, folks. I'm just here to tell you, as someone who studied behavioral psychology, you shouldn't even talk to a 1 year old like that. You should talk to a 1 year old like they're 100 years old.
Yeah,
you know,
they understand everything too.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah,
they understand it way better than you do.
Yeah, actually, it's the same with the cats and the dogs. They understand everything that's being said. Just like people say, "Oh, I can't say all these things in front of a 1 year old because he doesn't understand anything." It's not true.
Yeah,
they understand your emotions. They understand, might not understand every single word. I mean, I always say, don't talk. You know, if you talk rocket science,
yeah,
they might not understand. But they understand. Are you upset about it? Are you happy about it? Are you, you know, how do you feel about that? They understand everything. And the baby talk is so funny because so many people do baby talk with their cats or their dogs. And I once had a client and she kept doing baby talk with her cats. And I worked with her for a while. And she still kept doing the baby talk. And after a while, I didn't want to say anything anymore because it's not my place, right? So I asked the cats and I said, doesn't it bother you that she still does the baby voice with you?
We love her for who she is.
And the cats, you know what the cats said? They said, that's okay. She needs that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, exactly.
It was so funny. The cats were up here saying, you know, no. Up here, the cats were saying she needs that. Yeah. They were looking down at her saying, well, it's okay. Yeah she
no,
needs
no.
that.
No, we're going to meet so her funny. Right where she's at. It's
exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's just it. You know, once again, that idea of, I get through my many years of working with individuals from ages 4 to 40, I've come to find out the only difference is by age 40, you should know better than to pull people's hair without permission. You know, there is a great understanding that happens beyond words, that comes down to emotion, that comes down to instinct, that comes down to facial expression, micro expressions, things like that. And it's not until we get caught up in the nuances of what we think and why we think it, do we start thinking that somebody else has ulterior motives to what they're saying and why they're saying it. You know, until then, we have a pretty good meter on things and a pretty good understanding of even whether or not to trust somebody. You know, one of my greatest joys ever was my kid was probably about 6 years old and my wife and he were in the gas station. She was just choosing a drink from the cooler and he was looking at the little cooler of ice creams. And some guy came up and asked, what ice cream are you looking at getting, buddy? And he just kept looking at ice cream and went over to my wife and they went and they checked out. She was like, What did that guy say to you? And he was like, he was asking me what ice cream I was gonna buy. She was like, did you talk to him? He's like, no, something was just weird. And she's like, trust that. Keep in touch with that, you know, because there was just something, because he will talk to strangers about the deepest things, all kinds of stuff, Sylvie. But there was something in that moment that he just didn't jibe with.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. It's the same with cats or with dogs. They see right through the person. They pick up these nuances where we, let's say we adults, we are very much in our heads. I mean, even we spiritual people, we still are in our heads, right? And we get distracted by maybe somebody's appearance. He looks like a very integral person, or he looks like he's dressed well and he behaves well. So we might get fooled by somebody's appearance or their social status or whatever. Yeah. But cats, dogs, children, they understand, they see right through all that. They pick up the energy of the person. They pick up the intention of the person. And we have unlearned that. So we can actually learn something from the children, from the cats, from the dogs in that respect, because they pick up on all the nuances when we get fooled by somebody's looks or appearances or status, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And much like you mentioned about the lady with the baby talk, they're there to judge us about our mistakes of misgivings either. You know, they're pretty just like, well, yeah, you know, I could have told you that, buddy. But
yeah. And they don't, the beautiful thing is they don't care about our appearances. They don't care about when we beat ourselves up over something. I should have done that better. I don't know, I have a bad hair day or something, right? The cats don't care about that. The dogs don't care about that. We can have all the bad hair days that we want. They just want us to be happy. They see through all that. We cannot fool them. We cannot fool them by saying, I'm fine. I'm happy. I'm fine. Everything's fine. They look at you and say, no, you're not fine. Stop lying to yourself, right? Stop pretending everything is fine. When we talk to a friend and the friend says, how are you? We say, I'm fine. I'm okay. Everything's fine. And it's really not, but we're saying it, right? Yeah. You cannot do that to your cat or your dog or your kid for that matter. They will see right through that. And that's beautiful because they see the true us. They see who we truly are. They love us for who we truly are. That is how they love us unconditionally, exactly how we are, a shadow side and everything we're trying to not show to the world. They know our shadow side and they love us anyway. And that's what makes it so precious to have a cat or a dog companion.
Absolutely. Sylvie, I want to thank you for a beautiful and honest conversation about this. I can't wait to have you on again to talk about it because I think, I mean, A, companions to begin with are important. I think the word pets is wrong. That entails some sort of servitude in some kind of way. And really what it is it's a stewardship and it's a mutual stewardship. While we have decided to steward them with house and home, they have decided to steward us emotionally and psychologically and spiritually. And that is a beautiful arrangement. That is one of the most beautiful, pure arrangements that you can ever get, Sylvie. So thank you for helping facilitate that. Thank you for helping people learn about that beautiful arrangement. Where can people go to find out more? Where can they go to take your courses? Where can they go for private sessions if they have a cat who has a special corner, I guess, that they need to put a litter box in?
Put a litter box in and watch for what happens. Think about what happens in it. Yes, everything is on my website, sylviesterling.com. It hosts my classes. It hosts my membership. It hosts, it has a link to private sessions. I don't always offer private sessions. So when you go there and you see no openings, then check back the next month or drop me a line, contact me directly. I focus on the classes, the membership, and basically sylviesterling.com. That is where you can find everything about me and my work. I have a YouTube channel, a small one, but it's growing. And I love what you said at the end. I couldn't have said it better. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking the time. And once again, for the honest and open, candid conversation. I am somebody who thinks that we all need that in our life, and we all need some new prism through which to scatter the light, because everything gets a little monochrome sometimes. So the more facets through which we look at the world, I think the better understanding we have. So thank you for helping polish that facet today.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
It's a pleasure being on your show.
Same here. Hold the line real quick while we close things out with the audience. While you were online, everybody, checking out everything from Sylvia Sterling over at sylviasterling.com, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can like, follow, subscribe. That is where you can find all of our episodes. That's also where you can find our store, where you can find all of the books, music, videos, courses, everything from our guests. That's also where you can find your link to Curious Research in the Field Observation and Encounter Log. If you are an investigator in the world of paranormal, cryptozoology, UFO, UAP field research, doing investigative journalism, what have you, in those fields, this is your back pocket log to write down all of your witness statements, all of the happenings, all of the data that you find in the field in a scientific way, so that you are ready to shake hands with science come the day you need to do so. Thank you so much for your open hearts, your open minds today, everybody. That is what makes the conversation. And without the conversation, humanity does not march forward. So remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and stay curious. We'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. To download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault, or become a sponsor of Curious Realm, visit our website at CuriousRealm.com. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast and video services, CuriousRealm.com, as well as KGRA Radio, APR TV, and the official Curious Realm app for Roku devices. Curious Realm is a proud member of the Ground Zero Media family of podcasts. For more shows and members-only content, visit groundzeroplus.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.